for a student, you're allowed to come up to the meeting after the test is done. Sam, I'll do that one. Give me the other one. I'll photocopy it.
I'll make a teacher for that. I don't know why.
Today we're going to look at the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel. Of course, we can't get real deep into a lot of these books. We can only give you the real heart behind them. But let's look at the book of Daniel. The title is taken from the author, of course. And the word Daniel means God is my judge. God is my judge. That's what Daniel means, Daniel. And it's suggesting God's defense of him. And you remember that Daniel, according to history, was actually in Babylon as a captive, and yet God was his defender. God was his judge. Jesus Christ confirmed the historical accuracy of the book of Daniel by alluding to prophecies from Daniel and calling Daniel a prophet. And incidentally, this book has been, of course, attacked historically. And the reason why is that many authorities say, well, it's too accurate in its prophecies. Especially Daniel chapter 11, I think of. It gives a record of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And the picture there is so minute about this king overthrowing this king and this queen being overthrown by this king. And it goes back and forth, verse after verse after verse after verse. And it is so accurate and it is so minute that the critics have said it could not have been prophesied. It had to be written after the fact. But they fail to understand that God knows everything. It's no problem for God to give it before the fact. You can read of that in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 15. Matthew 24, 15. And then we also find that Daniel is mentioned in the book of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel chapter 14 and verse 14. And there he's cited along with Noah and Job as being an example of a righteous, godly man. Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 14. Now, Daniel very well may have been a member of the royal seed. Undoubtedly, he was of the tribe of Judah, but he may have actually been a member of the royal family. Let me read to you Daniel chapter 1, verse 3. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, so on and so forth. So it's talking about these children being children of the king's seed, and that, of course, would include Daniel. The book of Daniel is sometimes called the Apocalypse of the Old Testament because it presents such a majestic sweep of prophetic history. It talks about the ancient Babylonian Empire. It talks about the Persian Empire and the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire. And Daniel brings out how that these kingdoms are going to come and go, but God is going to establish his people forever. And the nation of Israel is going to have to be ruled over by these Gentile powers, and they're going to rule over them for so long, but at the end of it, Messiah's kingdom is going to obtain victory over them all. So Daniel becomes God's prophetic mouthpiece to the Gentiles and the Jewish world, declaring God's eternal purposes. Now let's look at the historical background for the book of Daniel. The destruction of the tribe of Judah and the nation of Judah came in three stages. Now I want to mention all three of those stages. First of all, in 605, the Babylonians came down against Judah, and it was the king Nebuchadnezzar. He came down and he brought the king of Judah, Jehoiakim, to his knees. Excuse me. And he carried Jehoiakim and a number of others away captive. Now, amongst those that were carried away captive in 605 BC by the Babylonians were three Hebrews called Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. And along with them was Daniel. So those four Hebrew children. You can read about that in Daniel chapter 1, 1 through 7. It will list those three for you. Daniel chapter 1, 1 through 7. And that was a very customary thing for ancient kings to do, to capture a captive people and to take the children, take them back home with you again, and to train them in the ways of working in the palace. And these young men would grow up and they would serve the king in the palace. And they would be like a foreign slave, as it were, serving the king in the palace. Well, their names were changed to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel's name was changed to Belteshazzar. So that was the first carrying away in 605. Well, then there was a second carrying away later on in 597. And in 597, under Jehoiakim again, and Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar carried away a second group of Jews. This time he carried off about 10,000 people captive, and among them were Ezekiel the prophet. And with that, you can read in Ezekiel chapter 1, 1 through 3. Ezekiel chapter 1, 1 through 3. That's the second carrying away in 597. Then finally in 586, there was a third carrying away. And in 586, there was a long siege of the Babylonians against the city of Jerusalem. And they destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and they burned the temple down, and they took a number of people back with them captive during that time as well. And you can read in 2 Kings chapter 25 for that. 2 Kings chapter 25. Well, this is where we have Daniel entering into the picture of Babylonian history. Because all of a sudden, Daniel is carried away captive, and there he is in the very court of the king of Nebuchadnezzar himself. And Nebuchadnezzar got a number of perplexing dreams that no one else in the kingdom could interpret. And therefore, Daniel was called upon to interpret these dreams, and he successfully did that, and eventually he's promoted over the entire kingdom of Babylon itself, directly under Nebuchadnezzar. And later on, he interpreted other dreams for Nebuchadnezzar as well. And so he starts a lengthy career and served under a number of kings in Babylonia, as well as a few in Persia as well. Let me outline the book for you here. Let me kind of break it down a little bit. First of all, there is chapters 1 through 6. Chapters 1 through 6 is a historical section. There is some prophecy in this section, but primarily it is historical in nature. Let me tell you what's in each chapter. In chapter 1, we find the reason for the fame of Daniel. And the reason why he became famous is that he purposed not to eat the king's meat. And Nebuchadnezzar wanted to feed Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego these choice, dainty meats of the king. Probably a lot of unclean meat, you know, lobster from the Persian Gulf and crabs and things like that or whatever. And they refused to eat it. They said, nothing doing. We're not going to eat it. And so the leader that was in charge of them became very distraught because he needed to make sure that they kept on eating to receive their health. And so what Daniel said, now look, you just feed us this other meal, feed us vegetables and so forth, and you just look at our countenance a number of days later, and that's what they did, and they found out that they were healthier than anyone else. So right at the outset, we see that Daniel is a man of God, he's a man of purpose, a man of integrity, he's a man that will stand for what he believes is right. Well, that leads us to chapter 2. And in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a very perplexing dream. And in this dream, he sees this picture of a great image, a great stone, and, well, not stone per se, but a great image that is standing there in his dream. And actually, it's a very, very mysterious image. It has a head made out of gold, and it has a breast made out of silver. And then it has thighs made out of brass. And then it has legs made out of iron. And then it has, like, feet made out of iron and clay. Very strange image. Well, Nebuchadnezzar was perplexed by this dream, and he could not find anyone to tell him what it meant. And so again, the services of Daniel are called upon. And Daniel is able to interpret this dream, and here's what Daniel tells him. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. The kingdom of Babylon is the head of gold. And so the head of gold stands for your kingdom. But your kingdom is going to fall to another kingdom, And the next kingdom, the breast of silver, is going to conquer you. And the breast of silver would symbolize the kingdom of Medo-Persia, the Persians. And that's exactly what happened historically. The Persians came and conquered the Babylonians. And then Daniel said, now the thighs of brass, they would point to the Grecian kingdom, or the kingdom of Greece. Now, he's not giving all these names. I'm kind of paraphrasing what it really means here. But there are the thighs of brass. They pointed to the Greek kingdom. And then the legs of iron, they pointed to the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire would be like iron, very hard, very brittle, non-yielding. And then the feet of iron and clay, that points to the kingdom of the Antichrist. And then after he saw this whole image, which was talking about all the future Gentile nations that would have to rule over the Jews before Messiah comes, Babylon would have to, Medo-Persia would have to, Greece would have to, Rome would have to, an Antichrist. All of a sudden, there was a stone that just came out of nowhere, and the stone came and it smashed the image right on the feet, landed on the feet of the image, and the entire image was annihilated, smashed. And it was just kind of like the chaff of a threshing floor, and just was kind of blown about by the wind and disappeared. Now the stone, which was a stone cut out of the mountains without hands, represents Jesus Christ. And the stone represents the second coming of Jesus, and he's going to smash the feet of the image. He's going to smash the Antichrist kingdom, and his kingdom is going to become a stone that will fill the entire earth. And that was the basic vision that God gave to Nebuchadnezzar for our knowledge of the future Gentile kingdoms. Very, very impressive vision. Well, then we come to chapter 3. Famous account here, the account of the fiery furnace. And this was a furnace probably for baking clay bricks and using them for building buildings, see? And Nebuchadnezzar got this bright idea from the devil of making this big image and having everyone bow down to it. Well, there were a couple of feisty Jews that said, no way, we're not going to bow down to it. And there were three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they said, no way, Nebuchadnezzar, we won't bow down to your image. And so what Nebuchadnezzar did then is threw them into this fire. And, of course, the outcome of it is that he looks into the burning fire, and there are four inside the burning fire. The angel of the Lord is there with them in that midst of that fire. Well, the outcome of this whole thing is that Nebuchadnezzar extols Yahweh and passes an edict that everyone in the land is to worship Yahweh. Now, he had a very perverted knowledge of God. He did not ever become a full-fledged proselyte, very rudimentary knowledge of God. So he did not really carry this far enough. So later on, he became proud and fell again. And that's chapter 4. Chapter 4, there is another dream or vision that comes to Nebuchadnezzar, and he sees this big tree, and the fowls of the air are landing in it, and the beasts of the field are standing under it for shade. And he can't figure out what this dream is, and lo and behold, the tree is cut down, and the tree is no more. And he sees a stump, and from the stump there's a sprout coming. Could not figure out what it meant, so he calls upon the services of Daniel again. And Daniel said, well, let me tell you, Nebuchadnezzar, what's going to happen. Because you have become proud in your heart and you don't give glory to God, God's going to cut you down. You're the tree. And God's going to cut you down, and there are going to be 7 years of insanity that you're going to experience. But God isn't going to utterly cut you down. You're like the stump. You'll sprout again. And after 7 years, you'll learn that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. And so Nebuchadnezzar is strutting around like a peacock with his feathers unfurled on his palace one day. And he looks out and he says, is not this great Babylon that I have built, taking all the glory to himself? And God said, I heard your words there, Nebuchadnezzar. And God judged him, and he walks around on all fours eating grass like a beast. And his nails get real long, and his hair grows like feathers on a bird. And they would throw him food or let him graze on the grass of the field or whatever. And after 7 years, God brought him out of that trial. You talk about a mind battle. That's one magnum opus right there, feeling like you're a beast. After 7 years, God delivered him from that demonic oppression, and that's what it was. And he knew that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. And then we come to chapter 5, another vision. And this is the account of Belshazzar's feast. Now, Belshazzar was a successor, even though there were several in between him and Nebuchadnezzar. He was a distant successor to Nebuchadnezzar. And this king called Belshazzar is sitting in his temple, sitting in his palace, I should say. And he's sitting in there, and they're drinking, and they're partying, and they're reveling in all their wickedness and so forth. And they're using the very vessels from the temple to drink their wine from. And they're laughing and they're carousing at the feast of their gods and so forth. And at the very height of their folly, there's a mysterious hand that appears out of nowhere. And there's some handwriting that occurs on the wall, and the handwriting cannot be read by anyone. And of course, the very loins of Belshazzar are loosed, and his knees begin to smite each other. And he's afraid. I mean, if you were sitting in your house eating your meal, and a hand appeared out of nowhere and started writing on the wall, you'd be alarmed too. And they could not find anyone to decipher the handwriting on the wall. And so again, and lastly, the services of Daniel are called for. And Daniel reads the interpretation, and Daniel basically says, Belshazzar, you and your kingdom are weighed in the balances and found wanting. This night God is going to take the kingdom of Babylon from you, and he's going to give it to the Medes and the Persians. And that very night the Persians came in and conquered the city of Babylon, and it collapsed overnight without even a real battle. Well, then we come to chapter 6, the end of the historical section. A very famous account, the lion's den. And this is the account where Daniel is now under a Persian king. The Babylonians have now collapsed. And there were a number of Persian princes that were so jealous of Daniel. Daniel was such a man of God. And so they unwittingly, as far as the Persian king was concerned, got the king to pass this decree that everyone must pray unto the king and stop their own personal praying. Daniel refused to submit to that, and eventually, to make a long story short, Daniel ends up in the lion's den. And of course, God was able to deliver him from that. Brought great glory to the name of God. Well, then we come to the prophetical section, the second major section of the book. The prophetical section is found in chapter 7 through 12. Chapter 7 through 12. Let me briefly go through this section for you. First of all, we come to chapter 7. Now, most of the events in this section are dreams or visions that relate to the future Gentile nations that are going to reign over Israel and Judah. First of all, in chapter 7, there is a vision of four beasts, four powerful beasts that Daniel sees. The first one is a lion. The lion symbolizes Babylonia. The second one is a bear, which symbolizes Medo-Persia, a second kingdom that would rule over the Jews. The third beast that he sees is a leopard, very fierce leopard, symbolizing Greece. So the lion equals Babylon, the bear Medo-Persia, and the leopard Greece. And then he sees a terrible vision, and you can't even describe it. It's got iron teeth, it's got brass claws, it's got a bunch of horns on its head. So terrible, he could not even relate it to anything else in the animal kingdom. And it symbolizes the Roman kingdom, and eventually the Antichrist kingdom as well. It really has a double application, both the Roman and the Antichrist kingdom. Well, then you come to chapter 8, and chapter 8 is an extensive vision of a ram and a rough goat. Picture of a ram, you know what a ram is. A ram and a rough goat. And the ram symbolizes the kingdom of Medo-Persia, and this ram is very powerful in nature. And then we find that there is a rough goat. And the rough goat flies with full fury, smashes into the ram, smashes into the kingdom of Medo-Persia, and breaks it and shatters it. And the rough goat symbolizes Greece and Alexander the Great. Rough goat equals Greece. And also there are visions of the Antichrist as well in this passage, chapter 8. Then we come to chapter 9. Of course, I'm just very simply telling you what are in these chapters. When you come to chapter 9, it is the famous vision of the 70 weeks of Daniel. The 70 weeks of Daniel. Now, Daniel receives a vision, and from the time of the decree to go forth and build the temple to the coming of Messiah, there are to be 69 weeks of years. Now, a week is symbolizing a week of years. So it's talking about a lengthy period of many years here and not actual weeks of days. But at any rate, there are many, many years, 69 years, 69 weeks of years, I should say, to the coming of Christ. And there is one final week, the 70th week of Daniel. And that week is divided into two sections. Half of it is fulfilled in the first 3.5 years ministry of Jesus Christ. And the other half, the final 70th week of Daniel, is reserved for the end time. It's not real clear to my mind exactly when that is fulfilled. either when the 144,000 are sealed, that 3.5 years, or perhaps after Jesus comes back again after the second coming. But at any rate, it's talking about 70 weeks all told before Messiah comes back and rules over the land of Palestine in full power again. And that's not going to occur until after the second coming. Well, then we come to chapter 10. Chapter 10 is a vision of Yahweh's glory. The vision of Yahweh's glory. And we see the angel of Yahweh manifesting himself in great glory to Daniel. Then we come to chapter 11. And in chapter 11, there are two primary groups that are talked about here, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. The Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And the Ptolemies, their name is spelled P-T-O-L-E-M-I-E-S, and the Seleucids, that is spelled S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D-S. Now, they were successors to Alexander the Great, and they were actually Greek rulers, and the Seleucids reigned the land of Syria up to the north of Palestine, and the Ptolemies were reigning down south in the land of Egypt. And they were reigning in between during the time of the 400 years of silence between Malachi and the coming of Christ, basically. This is just a real general picture here. And they would often fight each other for control of Palestine. And there were some of the rulers that were such a perfect picture of the Antichrist. I think of Antiochus Epiphanes. He was one of the Seleucids. And so what this is, it's a prophecy of the war between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. However, a lot of it looks down to the time of the end in which the Antichrist and his kingdom is going to appear on the earth. And so that's basically an extensive prophecy of them. Then in chapter 12 is a picture of the great tribulation and the two resurrections, the resurrection of the righteous and the resurrection of the wicked. And then what God tells Daniel at the end of the book, Daniel says, Lord, tell me what all these things mean. I think he knew what some of them meant, but a lot of the book was mysterious to him, a lot of the visions he got. And God said, Daniel, go your way, for this is not designed for you to understand it. It is sealed up till the time of the end. And so we're living during the time of the end, and God is beginning to open up the books of Daniel and the book of Apocalypse as never before, and God is beginning to reveal the real meaning and purpose behind these books. The purpose for the book of Daniel is threefold, three different purposes. Number one, it shows that Yahweh is the one true sovereign God. Oh, Babylon will come, and Babylon will be a powerful nation. Medo-Persia will field like 3 million men at one time in a single battle. Rome will come with its iron legions. Antichrist will come with its powerful forces. The Bible says that the peoples of the earth are going to cry out, who shall make war with the Antichrist? And yet, still, God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men. God sets the kingdoms up, and God allots them so much time, and when that kingdom is done, God says you're no longer going to reign, and they collapse and they fall in their own dust. And when you look at all the kingdoms that have reigned, they're all third-rate powers right now. Babylon is the kingdom of Iran right now. Of course, Rome is Italy right now. Greece, the land of Greece right now, of course, that's the same. Greece is so poor today that if you want to leave the country of Greece to go to school in America, you can only take so much money with you. They won't allow you to take too much money out of the country. They need every bit of money they can in their own country. And I think of also some of the other kingdoms that at one time were world kingdoms, Egypt and so forth. They're all third-rate countries right now because God reigns in the affairs of man. The second purpose for the book of Daniel is to chart prophetically God's dealings with the nation of Israel. To let the Jews know that before Messiah's kingdom comes in, and God gave them the basic amount of time it would take to bring about Messiah's kingdom, but before that would come to pass, these other nations would have to rule over them, like Babylon and Rome and Persia. And then number three, the third purpose, is to reveal the eventual triumph of Messiah's kingdom over every single earthly power. Messiah's kingdom is going to triumph. And you can read about that in chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 34 through 35. chapter 2, 34 through 35. Now, what I want to do real briefly, and I know I've been going kind of fast here, but let me compare some of the visions for you in some of the various chapters, just real briefly. For example, and I'll do this with seven different individuals or nations. For example, in the first one is this. In chapter 2, we see the head of gold. Okay? So chapter 2, we have the head of gold. And then when you turn over to chapter 7, the head of gold becomes a lion. It's the same as the lion with eagle's wings. And the interpretation of the head of gold and the lion with eagle's wings is the kingdom of Babylon. And the kingdom of Babylon reigned from about 612 to 539 B.C. 612 to 539 B.C. So that's one comparison. Here's the second one. The second comparison, we have the breast and the arms of silver. That's seen again in chapter 2. In the image in chapter 2, the breast and the arms of silver. Now, what that becomes in chapter 7, that becomes a bear. And this bear raises itself up on one side. And that's talking about Medo-Persia, the kingdom of Persia. Actually, Medo-Persia was two kingdoms. It started off as Media and Persia. And when it talks about the bear raising itself up on one side, it's just simply telling you that Media was the predominant kingdom when it started, but then eventually Persia became the strongest kingdom. Now this becomes the ram with two horns in chapter 8. So it's a bear in chapter 7, then it turns into a ram with two horns in chapter 8. So that's the second comparison. Here's the third one for you. The third one we see, first of all, in chapter 2, a belly and a thighs of brass. Belly and thighs of brass. And that becomes a leopard in chapter 7. And this leopard in chapter 7 has got four wings on it. That's talking about Alexander the Great's kingdom. It conquered the world very rapidly. A leopard is one of the fastest mammals, I suppose, around as far as a land animal. And when you add four wings to it, now it's really zipping across the field. And so it becomes a leopard. It starts off as a belly and thighs of brass, and then becomes a leopard with four wings. And then in chapter 8, it becomes a he-goat. Turns into a he-goat with a great horn right in the middle of its head. And that symbolizes Alexander the Great, the horn does. And this whole thing would speak of the kingdom of Greece. So it's a belly of brass, and it's a leopard with four wings, and it's also a he-goat. Greece reigned from about 331 to 63 B.C. Did I give a date for Medo-Persia? A date for Medo-Persia, which was the bear raised up on one side, is from 539 to 331. 539 to 331. And then for Greece, it is 331 to 63 B.C. 331 to 63 B.C. Now, number four, the fourth event or the fourth image or vision that we see the legs of iron in chapter 2. And the legs of iron in chapter 2 become a fourth beast in chapter 7. He is indescribable, cannot describe him. No words are adequate to relate this beast. All Daniel can say is he's beyond words. And he's got iron teeth. Now, what this symbolizes is the kingdom of Rome, the Roman Empire. And that's exactly how they reigned. They were a powerful kingdom. I'll tell you, when those legions came marching against the ancient cities, it struck fear in their heart. They would often come with a great show of power, and the Romans would march, and often the Romans would lock their shields together above their heads, and the Roman general would often be running with his chariot on top of their shields, in his chariot, clattering across their shields as they would march along in perfect unison, and you peer out over the top of your wall, and here are these legions coming with their gold, with the golden eagle and the red banners flying and everything, with a general racing on his chariot on top of the shields of the soldiers, with all their, you know, catapults and everything creaking along behind them with their battle elephants. They were an iron beast. It was indescribable. Indescribable. Rome reigned from about 63 B.C., to AD 470. 63 BC to AD 476. Now, number five. The fifth one that we see is the feet and the ten toes of iron and clay. The feet and the ten toes of iron and clay. Now, that becomes, in chapter 7, the ten horns of the fourth beast. There's a double application here with the Roman Empire. It kind of overlaps. It's the same beast now as the Roman Empire, but there are ten horns on it. And out of those ten horns, one is a notable horn. And that's talking about the Antichrist kingdom. He's going to rule, he's going to reign with ten horns. And yet he's going to be the notable horn, see? And he's going to be iron-like in nature. And when it talks about the iron and the clay, the iron would symbolize the great political power that the Antichrist kingdom is going to have. And then the clay would symbolize the religious power. And in chapter 13 of the book of Revelation, we read about the false prophet coming up out of the earth, and the false prophet is going to be involved in getting the whole world now to take the mark of the beast, and the false prophet has got two horns like a lamb and speaks as a dragon. So the iron and the clay would symbolize the political power merged together with the religious power, forming the Antichrist kingdom in the latter days. That's the fifth event that we really see. Now, fortunately, the book of Daniel does not end there. Praise God. There's another vision yet to be seen. And there's a stone cut out of a mountain without hands. No man cut this stone out. And that's seen in chapter 2. And what this stone does, the stone comes and it lands on that image, right on the feet, smashes it to smithereens. And that stone cut out of the mountains, it's talking about the Son of Man. And it's telling us, the interpretation here is that the kingdom of God is going to be established by the Messiah. And Messiah is going to come at the second coming. He's going to land right on those ten toes. He's going to land on those ten horns. He's going to land on the Antichrist and his kingdom. He's going to smash them. And it talks about that kingdom. It's going to become like the chaff of a threshing floor as wheat. It's going to be blown with the four winds. You won't be able to find it any longer. And the time of Gentile domination over the Jews has come to an end. The Gentiles are not going to rule over Judah any longer. So that's really the heart behind Daniel, the fact that these future Gentile powers would have to come and have to reign for so long before Messiah's kingdom would come. Very, very beautiful, very powerful book. Let me conclude with a final summary of the theme of the book of Daniel for you. I believe that Daniel, by way of the theme, was written to encourage the exiled Jews by revealing to them God's sovereign program for Israel during and after a period of Gentile dominion. I believe that God was showing the Jews that the times of the Gentiles is going to begin with the Babylonian captivity, and that Israel would have to suffer after under the Gentile powers for many years, but eventually the time would come when God would establish the Messianic kingdom forever. And so the book therefore emphasizes the sovereignty and the power of God over human affairs. Okay, are there any questions on the book of Daniel? Let's talk about the minor prophets. I don't know, maybe you know more about than I do as far as these books are concerned, but some beautiful, beautiful books here. Let's talk about the minor prophets. Just a brief introduction to the minor prophets themselves before we look at them individually. First of all, the word minor does not mean less important. It doesn't mean that they are not as significant as the major prophets. And, of course, the major prophets are Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel and Lamentations written by Jeremiah. It doesn't mean that they are less important. It just simply means they are smaller in size. That's all it means. Here's a fact. The minor prophets are quoted more often in the New Testament than the major prophets are. And some of the most significant prophecies in the New Testament that are quoted occur from the minor prophets. For example, Peter quoted Joel on the day of Pentecost. Stephen backed up his argument with a quote from Amos in Acts chapter 15, or Acts chapter 7. And then James quotes from Amos at the Council of the Elders in Acts chapter 15. So many key quotes occur directly from the minor prophets. Also, there are some many important prophecies that occur in the New Testament. For example, Micah prophesied of the very birthplace of the coming of Messiah in Micah chapter 5, verse 2, tells us the very place that Messiah would be born, Micah 5, 2. Zechariah prophesied of the crucifixion, chapter 12 and verse 10. And then Jonah prophesied of the resurrection of Jesus in Jonah chapter 2. And then there are many prophecies of the second coming, the battle of Armageddon, the millennial battle, and many other important key prophecies. Now, the minor prophets ministered from about the 9th century B.C. to the 5th century B.C. That's about the period of time from about roughly 800 to 400 B.C. They ministered and prophesied during that time. About 800 to 400 B.C. Now, when you look at the Old Testament initially was written, let's just say roughly about 1600 B.C. From 1600 to 400 B.C. So the minor prophets cover about half that period of time then, about half of that period. They cover about a 400-year span of history, and they move through the following empires. They move through the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, and the Persian Empire. They move through those periods of time. Now, I'm going to discuss them in order a little bit differently than what we have in our King James Bible. I'm going to begin with the book of Obadiah. I'm going to start with the oldest and work my way towards the more recent. But here's the order I'm going to follow: Obadiah, Joel, Jonah, Amos, Hosea, Micah, Nahum, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So those are the ones I'm going to look at. Let's begin with Obadiah, first of all. The title, of course, comes from the author's name. The author is Obadiah, and the name Obadiah means servant of Yahweh. Servant of Yahweh. There's really nothing known of him in the Bible, so I can't tell you much about Obadiah. The same name is used for 11 others in the Old Testament, according to Unger's Bible Dictionary. So it's a very common name, but I really don't have a lot of information to give you about Obadiah himself. The date of the book, very old, very ancient minor prophet book, goes all the way back, probably around 840. And so sometime within the period of time, 840 to maybe 830 B.C., 840 to 830. There really are not a lot of clear indicators as far as the exact date. Now, there's one clear theme in the book of Obadiah. Very simple, clear theme. One extended prophecy given in vision form. Very simple. The destruction of the land of Edom and the restoration of the land of Israel. The destruction of Edom and the restoration of Israel. How many of you know where the Edomites came from? Anyone know where they came from? Yes. Yeah, they came from Edom. Where did Edom come from? That's a brilliant point there, Kirk. You're right on top of things. I appreciate that. The Edomites came from a man called Esau. You've heard of Esau. And the Israelites, now they came from Jacob. And it's very interesting because there was a struggle between Esau and Jacob from their mother's womb. Remember that account? Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25. Let's read verse 21 and following. This will tell us about the origin of the Edomites and the Israelites. Genesis chapter 25, verse 21. It says, "And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, 'If it be so, why am I thus?' And she went to inquire of the Lord." It's bad enough when you've got one kid kicking in your womb, but when two get together and kick like soccer players in your womb, and it seemed to be struggling and wrestling with each other, it's a rather disconcerting thing. So Rebekah inquires of the Lord. It says in verse 23, "And the Lord said unto her, 'Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger.'" Now the elder was Esau, and the younger was Jacob. "And one nation was to become stronger than the other. The Jewish nation and the descendants of Jacob were to become stronger than the descendants of Esau." Well, as you read the Bible very carefully, you find that Esau and Jacob struggled in the womb, and later on Esau was the first to be born, and so Esau really had the right to the birthright but sold it to Jacob, and later on held a grudge against Jacob. And there was great enmity that developed between the descendants of Jacob and Esau. I mean, they were bitter enemies very often throughout time. In fact, it was so bad that Edom refused the passage to Moses and Israel during the Exodus to the land of Palestine. Here are 3 million people marching to Palestine. And Moses promised the Edomites, they said, now we won't drink of your water, we won't take your cattle or anything, just let us pass through. And the Edomites said, nothing doing, even though the Edomites were related to them. And so consequently, the Israelites had to pass through the wilderness. It was a lot longer route. And it was through a much drier, barren area, and it caused them a lot of hardship because of the hardness of heart of the Edomites. That's found in Numbers chapter 20, verse 18. Numbers chapter 20, verse 18. Well, then we come to the time of King Saul. And King Saul was often battling against the Edomites again. And that's seen in 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 47. You can read about Saul battling with them. But to make a long story short, the Edomites were kind of like the Arabs today. And the same relationship between Israel and the Arabs today, that's exactly the way it was back during the time of Jesus Christ and even before then. The Edomites were constantly battling with the Jews. Now, they did have a capital in the land of Edom. Let me show you where Edom is, first of all. The capital was called Petra, the city of Petra. Edom is this stretch of land down here to the south of the Dead Sea. And there's a little town here called Sela, or Petra, and that was their capital. Very, very impressive, very unique city. Spelled like this. Spelled P-E-T-R-A, or also Sela, S-E-L-A-H. Petra or Sela. And it was perched like an eagle's nest amid inaccessible mountains, according to Obadiah, verse 4. There's only one chapter here in Obadiah, so when I give a reference, I won't give the chapter, I'll just give you the verse. But it's talked about in verse 4. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the city of Petra, because the Edomites had it really made for them as far as their country was concerned. Basically, Edom, the land, was just barren. It was stark, it was desert, there was really no agriculture that could support them or anything to really speak of. So what they did, they were bandits. And there were caravans that would travel down to the Gulf of Aqaba here. And as the caravans came down through here, the Edomites would run out and plunder these caravans. And then they would run back to their capital called Petra or Sela. Now, the only way you could get to Petra was through a deep rock cleft that was more than a mile long. And you'd have to get to Petra through this long, long ravine. And there were massive cliffs that rose more than 700 feet on either side. And often it was so narrow, this ravine that's a mile long, that only one man on one horse could ride through it. You couldn't even ride two people side by side. And so you would go like for a mile through this narrow, narrow little ravine with a little stream flowing down through the bottom of it. You go way back in for a mile, and then all of a sudden it would break out into a beautiful, beautiful large cavern. And of course it wasn't a cave, it was all open, it was like a basin. And it was made out of sandstone, and they carved all their homes on the walls of these sandstone cliffs. And there's no way that anyone could get in to destroy them, because if you brought an army, you'd have to go down through the ravine, and it was real easy for them to attack you, see, and just pick you off one after another. And so they were able to withstand any invasion that was launched against them. And there were over 1,000 temples that were numbered in the walls of the city of Petra. And so it was built literally out of pink rock on the sides of these massive cliffs. And the people dwelt then in this soft red sandstone. That's what they made their homes out of. So they would go out and they would plunder the caravans and they would plunder the Israelites, and then they would run back to the city of Petra. Nobody could get them. Nobody could attack them, see? Well, God didn't like that, and so God pronounces judgment on them. That's what this book is all about. Let me read a quote to you that describes the city of Petra. This is from George Robinson in his commentary, The 12 Minor Prophets, page 66. Let me read a little quote to you here. And incidentally, it's been remarkably preserved today, and you can go see it today. Many of the temples, many of the buildings are still there in a remarkable state of preservation. He says, and I quote, "For situation and natural beauty, Petra is unique among the cities of the earth. To describe it adequately is well nigh an impossibility. Its location deep down among the mountains of Seir, surrounded on all sides with richly colored rocks of simply matchless beauty and grandeur, renders it a wonder of the desert. One enters the weird but attractive city enclosure by a narrow gorge over a mile long called the Sick or Cleft. This defile is one of the most magnificent and romantic avenues of its kind in all of nature. A tiny stream flows under one's feet much of the way. The chasm is both narrow and deep, oftentimes so contracted as to be almost dark at noonday. The rocks which bound it are tinted most beautifully with all the colors of the rainbow. On emerging from it into the great hollow basin, which is over a mile long by two-thirds of a mile broad, the explorer is confronted by rock-hewn dwellings, tombs, temples, and other cuttings on every side. Several hundreds of these, most of them doubtless mausolea, where they buried their dead, still remain all carved literally out of solid sandstone rock. The ruins of the castle and of buildings and the arches of a bridge and columns still stand scattered over the bottom of the city's site. The colors of the rocks add immensely to the attractiveness of the place. The deepest reds, purple, orange, yellow, white, violet, and other colors are arranged by nature in alternate brands, shading off artistically into one another, curving and twisting in gorgeous fantasies according to the infiltration of the oxides of iron and manganese and other substances which so often produce beauty. The entire city and its environs are one immense maze of richly colored mountains and cliffs, chasms, rocky shelves, and narrow valleys, gorges and plateaus, shady dales and sunny promontories, grand and beautiful, just the idea of beauty and protection for a fortress of trade and commerce to satisfy an Oriental nomad. But alas, desolation now reigns within and about it on every hand, and Obadiah's warnings and predictions have been woefully verified," end quote. Well, I've got a number of slides and a number of pictures of this city. It is indeed beautiful. And I've talked to at least one person that has been there, and it's pretty much the way it's described here, just very, very, very beautiful, very, very stunning. Let me give you an outline for the book of Obadiah. First of all, Edom's doom is predicted in verses 1 through 16. The doom of Edom is predicted. And what we find in this section is that, first of all, the doom is declared by God, and then the doom is described, and then it is deserved. God gives the reasons why it is coming, and then the doom is accomplished. All those thoughts in this section. So first of all, predicted, verses 1 through 16. Then secondly, the deliverance of Israel is predicted. That's verses 17 through 21. Chapter 1, verses 17 through 21. The deliverance of Israel is predicted. Well, let me read a couple verses here to you. Let me mention four reasons why God brought judgment to the land of Edom. Four reasons. Can you find Obadiah in the Old Testament there? Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. The first reason is because of their pride and sinful self-security. They were full of pride. They just felt like no one could ever destroy them. They were arrogant. They were presumptuous. And, of course, God always will humble those that are proud. It says here in verse 3, "The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that sayest in thy heart, Who shall bring me down to the ground? Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord." So God is telling them, you may be proud in your geographical location, but I'm going to humble you, and I'm going to bring you down. Now there's a second reason why God is going to judge them, and that's because of their violence done to Judah. That is Jacob, indirectly, see. But the violence that they have done to Judah, look at verse 10. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. Very often they plundered the Jews. Very often they battled the Jews. They were bloodthirsty. They were actually warriors, see? And because of that, God was going to judge them. Now, there's a third reason, and that's because of their indifference to Jacob's trouble. You see, they were really related to Jacob. They were really related by blood to the Jews. But there were times when, like, the Assyrians came down, or the Babylonians came down and destroyed Jacob and destroyed the Jews, and Edom was unconcerned. They were indifferent, and they did not help the Jews. Look at verse 11. In the day that thou shouldest stood on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his foes, or forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. So the Assyrians would come down, and the Edomites would help them decimate Jerusalem, see? So God's going to judge them. And then finally, God is going to judge them because they would often rejoice over Judah's destruction. Judah would be destroyed, and the Edomites would rejoice. They'd have a big banquet and a big celebration. They'd come in, and they'd get the plunder. That's seen in verses 12 through 13. Now, let me summarize the message of Obadiah here for you. What we see is this. Haughty Edom, secure in her impregnable mountain fortress, is going to be judged by God. And they had plagued Israel over the years, and they did not help their brother in the time of need. And so God is going to judge them, and God is going to bring them down low. And not only that, but the people of God, Judah, is going to inherit Edom's territories, and the Jews are going to dwell in safety in the very land of Edom. And that, incidentally, has not yet come to pass. That will come to pass in the millennium. This is all parallel to the following scriptures here. Following scriptures, Isaiah chapter 34, 5 through 14, Jeremiah chapter 49, verse 7, Lamentations chapter 4, 21 through 22, Ezekiel 25, 12 through 14, and Amos chapter 1, 11 through 12. Now, concluding thoughts. This is the favorite book of the Jews. You know why? They regard it as a promise of the future overthrow of the Arabs. They apply the references here to Edom to the Arabs. And this has really spurred their hope. And also, they regard it as a victory in the future over the Christians as well. God's going to overthrow the haughty Christians as well. Little do they know they're going to become Christians. But also, another concluding thought is that it symbolizes the overthrow of the devil's kingdom. It seems like it is impregnable. It seems like he's perched his kingdom back there in the inaccessible rock. But I'll tell you something, though he has exalted himself as the stars and as the eagle, God is going to bring him down, and there's going to be great victory for the saints. Finally, it symbolizes the doom of those who are proud and rebellious, and the deliverance for the meek and the humble. Jesus said, "The meek shall inherit the earth." And that's really the theme and the thought that we see behind this book. Are there any questions with Obadiah? Yes.
Is that application correct to the Arabs?
Well, I think it is, yes. I think there is a real application. If you're to look at this area now, primarily, it would be, I suppose, on the borders of the Sinai Peninsula, which now belongs to Egypt again. The Jews gave that back to Egypt. That was part of the Mount David agreement, Camp David agreement, I guess. And then Jordan owns this portion of the land right here. And, of course, the land of Jordan is very hostile. They are Arabs. They're very hostile to the Jews now. So I think it is a valid application. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Arabs are all related to Egypt.
Yes, I think they are. I think the Arabs are related. I think it goes back to Ishmael, and they're descendants of Ishmael. But I think also the Edomites are tied in here too, if I'm not mistaken. It's rather complicated to trace the origin of the Arabs, but I think it's primarily Ishmael, but Edom occurs there too. Okay, you may be excused. Made it through two. The rest of these books, we're going to cover about as fast as we did Obadiah. And we'll get into the New Testament. Got to continue keeping a fairly steady pace, or we don't make it to the new heavens and the new earth. We don't make it to the book of Revelation. Don't make it in the rapture. You don't want to stay back here in the Old Testament in the land of Babylon.
Have a good weekend.
Next one at the end of the minor prophet.